Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. This afternoon, we welcome back Bob Berman, as we usually do once a month or so. Bob is here to answer all of your astronomy-related questions. He's one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world, and Bob is always a great guest on this program, always a popular guest, too, so I encourage you to get your calls in now and get in the queue. 1-800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551. You can also post your comments below today's Vox Pop wall post on our Facebook page, facebook.com/WAMC Radio. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop or email voxpop@wamc.org. I think that pretty much sums it all up. The number, once again, is 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Good to be here.
What do you think of the new studio? It's your first time in here.
It's beautiful. It's really beautiful.
Ian Pickus likens this to the inside of the Death Star on Star Wars.
Right.
With all the angles and the funny contraptions.
And the seats are comfortable.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, don't nod off. That's all I can ask. Boy, how about that lunar eclipse? Wow, it was beautiful.
Wow, did we get a lot of interest in it? You know, the world really woke up to that. And yeah, it was very cool. I think this is one of those things that everybody was aware of it. We had clear weather.
For a change.
Yeah, that was it. It just really worked. And on one of the websites that I work with, we had 3 million people just watching and calling in. And, you know, I know around here that pretty much everyone went out to take a look. So that was cool. I hope everybody will be as vigilant when it comes to our first total solar eclipse in this area since 1925, which is going to happen 2 summers from now.
Okay, but it's really not in this area.
Right. It'll be the continental U.S. We've not had one since 1979. And if a lunar eclipse like that one is, let's say on a scale of 1 to 100, if a total solar eclipse is 100, this might be a 5. And it's not me talking. Everybody will tell you that. This is interesting and beautiful in the same sense that watching beavers build a dam is interesting. A total solar eclipse makes people weep. It makes them shout. People cry. It's life-changing. And that's what we're going to get coming up in just 2 summers from now. So people should already be thinking of August 21st. Mark it on your calendar. Don't stay here where it'll be partial. Don't think that, oh, it's a partial eclipse. I'll get those solar glasses and look at it. You can go to a place where you don't need any solar glasses and see flames of nuclear fire leap from the sun's edge and stars come out in the daytime and see why everyone says that a total solar eclipse is life-changing. It's like nothing else in life, both visually and just experientially. It's like the best experience you've ever had. So I'm starting early. I know it's a whole 2 years away, but since you've talked about this eclipse, be psyched, be prepped for August 21st of 2017 to go where it's total. And there'll be maps all over the place on the internet showing exactly where the path is. And you just have to position yourself somewhere in that 100-mile-wide ribbon. They'll go through Wyoming and Illinois and end up even in Tennessee and just go
okay.
there.
Okay, but what if you go to Wyoming and it's cloudy?
Well, that's why you want to choose a place with a higher possibility of clear skies. For example, the eclipse starts in the Pacific Northwest, where common sense would tell you not to go.
Right.
And it finishes up in the southeastern states in the afternoon, which is also hazy and cloudy. You get a lot of afternoon clouds there. So the middle section of that, eastern Idaho, Wyoming, Illinois,
yeah,
in midday, late morning to midday, that'll be the ideal place.
1-800-348-2551 is our number. We talk astronomy with Bob Berman, and we're talking about the solar eclipse that's coming up in a couple of years now. So it's a 100-mile-wide, more or less, band where it's a total eclipse. Explain to us the mechanics of the solar eclipse and why we can only see it in a small portion.
Because the moon's shadow, which tapers like a chopstick to nothing, happens to go to nothing just about at Earth's distance from the moon. So any farther away than the moon is from Earth, and the shadow doesn't reach. So you have to be within that umbral shadow, that dark shadow, that full shadow, in order to see it. And it starts out with the moon's full diameter, 2,160 miles, but then tapers to just 100 miles by the time it hits Earth. So you have to be in that band to see it. If you're not, then in a much wider area, it's a partial solar eclipse, the kind that we get here every few years. And
right.
Everyone has seen that on, if not on TV, then on the internet, or with even with glasses that let you look at the sun safely. And it's not even remotely in the same ballpark. There's something about totality. It sounds kind of snobby to say, no, 99% eclipse won't do it. You have to have 100. But it's true. Something happens. Ray, when the sun and the moon and your spot on Earth form a straight line, I know I live not too terribly far from Woodstock, and it sounds Woodstocky to say this kind of thing, but there's a vibe, there's a feeling to it that transcends just the visual.
And the birds get quiet. I've not seen this, but reportedly
the birds get quiet and the temperature has fallen. And
how long does it last in totality?
This one will be a little over 2 minutes, 2 minutes and 30 seconds from locations in the middle of America.
It's a long drive to Wyoming for 2 minutes, man. All right, let's go to the phones. 1-800-348-2551. Bob in Delmar. Bob.
Hi. Great to have you back.
Thanks.
I was just wondering if you could possibly recommend a good telescope.
Well, you know, we're asked that a lot, and the problem is that there's no one-size-fits-all, because not only are there a lot of different prices in telescopes, ranging from like Walmart or Target level scopes for $100 to many say that the cheapest decent telescope is going to be at least $600 to $1,000, but there are types that require you to be fussy with it, that you adjust the mirror, collimate the mirror every year or so. And it's not a very hard job, but unless you're willing to do it, that's not worthwhile. But that's the biggest bang for the buck, a reflector telescope.
Yeah.
On the other hand, a refractor, the kind you look through, no hassle at all. The mirror, there is no mirror. The lens never goes out of collimation, but it's a small lens for what you're going to get for the money. And so it'll be good for the moon and the planets, but not good for galaxies or nebulae. And then there's a question of a drive. You know, everything in the sky moves. So within 30 seconds to a minute, whatever you pointed at won't be there anymore. So do you want to get one that has a tracking system, a motor, or at least an equatorial mount? Well, that adds another few $100s. But most people get a telescope, really don't know where to point it, and it ends up in the attic. So you know, it's a complex subject, and I'd almost say call up one of the big telescope companies, Orion or one of the others, and ask someone there for advice, and they'll be happy to just go on and on and tell you the specials they have that month and give you the pluses or the minuses, because there's a lot more to it, obviously, than just a simple, hey, I recommend this one.
And I mean, it's always dangerous to buy things used, but because of the phenomenon that you just described, Bob, where people get one, don't realize that they're not going to figure out how to use it, and then they put it away. You'll find a lot of used ones out there.
Yes, and that's probably a good deal. Just don't get one with a rickety mount, something that's the slightest bit shaky. Realize that you can't use them indoors through a window, whether it's open or closed. They have to be outdoors. So however much it weighs, you're going to have to carry that in and out from your lawn to your house. And, you know, just make yourself a little more aware of the vagaries and the hassle of using a telescope. Even the ones that say point that it has a go-to equipment that you press a button and it'll find its way to the target
great.
On its own. Sounds good, but they don't tell you have to have setup steps, usually three setup steps of pointing to three known stars, then aligning them and then press buttons. And honestly, most people aren't willing to go through that small amount of setup before they do it. So, you know, find out more about it before you do it. That's why I can't give you one recommendation, because one type isn't good for every need.
Yeah. And now, you have a sizable telescope. You have an
observatory.
Observatory.
Yes.
So that opens and closes?
Yes, motorized mount, a giant telescope.
Computerized?
Not computerized, no. In fact, if I'm not paying attention when I open and close it, it'll destroy itself, because the roof will open all the way to the stop and then go bam, and I have to really pay attention when I do
it. Okay, and so when you use that, and you say it's motorized, so you have to manually track the
No, I just press a button, and the thing will follow Saturn or the galaxy or whatever I'm looking at.
That's pretty amazing.
And it's a giant telescope, you need a ladder to even be able to get up there and look through it.
Now, how did you come up with that one?
No, that's been since 82, Overlook Observatory, and the equipment is really fine. But that's the way, because then you don't have to bring it in and out. It's permanently lined up, polar aligned, and it'll permanently capable of tracking. But then, you know, you have a bit of an investment.
Okay, and there's upkeep with whatever telescope you get. There's going to be upkeep, right?
Not in that case, because it's not going to be knocked into things, so the mirrors are not going to go out of alignment.
Don't they have to be cleaned, though, from time to time?
Not very often.
Really?
Yeah, once a decade.
Oh, that's not too bad. Yeah. So you've already done it once, and you've got another twice now, and you've got another one coming up?
It's pretty good still.
And
if you keep the ends covered so that dust doesn't go into the tube when it's not being used, it's pretty simple, actually.
In the time that you have had this set up, in 20, 30 years you've had the setup, has the light encroachment, the artificial light, been noticeable?
A little bit, yeah, a little bit. But we still have, most of our area still has clear skies, that is clear of light pollution. You know, not downtown Albany, obviously, and not right around, let's say, Poughkeepsie, but many of our listeners live in places that are where the skies are pretty darn good.
Yeah.
And stargazing, and whether with telescopes or binoculars or just naked eye, is pretty good from here.
Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. We talk astronomy. We'll get right back to the phones when we return.
Support comes from Cowan's Auctions, available for estate, trust, and full collection evaluations. George E. Heigl for consultations. 518-369-7994. Curtis Lumber, specializing in kitchen design, featuring Cambria quartz countertops and Merillat cabinetry and more. Designer consultations available. CurtisLumber.com. Bodhi Spa Yoga and Salon, Hudson. Daily yoga classes, plus haircuts and color, massage, body treatments, and facials. Scheduling hair and makeup services for weddings. BodhiHolisticSpa.com. Destination Williamstown, a calendar of curated events in the Northern Berkshires, culture, college, cows. DestinationWilliamstown.org. Congregation Shara Tefillah, Saratoga Springs, New York, an egalitarian, conservative synagogue, providing religious services, cultural events, adult education, gift shop, and more. SaratogaSynagogue.org for schedule. Envision Excel Eye Care, Lake Katrine, New York, providing eye exams, eye care, dry eye therapy, and more, where eyewear is an art. Facebook or VisionExcelEyeCare.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Bob Berman is our guest, and we talk astronomy every month or so, and this is your first time here in the new studio, and, your description of this observatory, which I've never seen, is quite something. So, the reflector on the telescope that you have on the mountain is?
That's a 12.5-inch F6, and it's back when they made research-grade telescopes that you could remotely afford, with the Takahashi 5-inch refractor-mounted piggyback. Everything's clock-driven, dual-axis, with spectroscopes. And I love this telescope. I just, sometimes I go in there and I just sit and I look at the telescope, not even through it. Because I love it so much.
So the spectroscope allows you to analyze gases in atmospheres or stars?
Yeah, so whenever we have, let's say, a school group or a scout group or we're doing some, teaching there, people love the intensity of the colors because the things in the actual sky tend to be very pastel.
Yeah.
And so with the spectroscope, if you look at, let's say, a star like Vega that has a very clear hydrogen spectrum, or Betelgeuse with lots of lines of even molecules like titanium oxide on it, the colors on the spectrum, because all the different wavelengths of light that have traveled, in the case of Vega, for 25 years before they've hit your eye, are just the richest, most beautiful colors. So people love that aspect of it, as well as the fact that spectroscopy is what astronomers do these days. 75% of all telescope time is spent on spectroscopy, not looking through it.
And yet you don't even have this set up to take pictures, right?
Not anymore. I did back 15, 20 years ago, back in the old gas hypersensitized film era. Now everybody uses CCDs.
Well, you could probably do that fairly inexpensively, right?
Yeah, I could, but I'm really into the direct image rather than the image on a screen or what you're going to get through CCDs. To tell you the truth, Ray, when you have the image on a screen, that's one thing. You look at Saturn, and yeah, there it is. But when people see it directly, there's something about the real thing. Half of all visitors say either, oh, my God, or that's not real. they think there's some kind of slide or picture pasted on the other of them. They say that's not real because the real celestial object has an impact, whereas the image in either a photograph or on a computer screen just doesn't.
Hmm. All right, let's go back to the phones. Fred in Hurley. Fred, thanks for waiting. You're on.
Hi, good afternoon. I have the great luck of being over Lincoln Center in the middle of the night, and I watch the eclipse, and I take my break in the middle of the night and get to watch the sky over New York City, over Lincoln Center. And so I didn't finish watching the return of the moon, but I have a question. I've been paying attention as far as the transverse of the moon across the sky, and I don't understand. My question is, I don't understand how do we revolve? You know, does the moon go all the way around the Earth in a day, kind of thing? That's my question, basically, because the amount of time that it takes for the moon to get from one point to another is like 6 hours, and I just don't understand how it works.
Okay, no, you're scowling, Ray, but I've got.
No, I'm not scowling, but because my kids asked me a similar question, and it's a lot tougher to explain than it is to understand.
Yes, well, here's the thing. Even though the moon is the only celestial object that orbits around us, and even though it looks like it's really moving around us as the night goes on, the motion that you saw was simply due to Earth's rotation. We spin so quickly that everything in the sky seems to move in the opposite direction just as quickly. So the moon travels from horizon to horizon in roughly 12 hours. That's entirely due to Earth spinning. Now, if you pay attention behind the moon, though, on a particular time, let's say there's a few bright stars in the vicinity of the moon, and watch it an hour, 2 hours, 3 hours later, you'll see that it has shifted relative to the background stars so that the moon is not crossing the sky as fast as the background stars are.
Remember, we're talking Lincoln Center. So
yes, yeah, well,
not,
even
not
right. That's right. That's right. That's right. So you don't see a lot of stars in the city, but on occasion there'll be some bright stars behind the moon. On occasion. So what I'm saying is that because the moon is going around us, it takes 27.32166 days to orbit once around us, but that's a lot slower than the 24 hours of our spin. So the gross motion, the one that you're going to notice and anyone's going to notice, is the moon crossing the sky thanks to Earth rotating in the opposite direction. But if you look closely and you can see any background stars, the moon is not crossing the sky quite as fast as the stars around it. The stars around it are crossing the sky exactly matching Earth's spin.
I've been studying the stars also. So,
okay, good, good, good.
As far as that goes. But I haven't applied it in that regard.
Good, good, good. Well, it's as simple as that. The stars are going around us exactly equal to the rate of our own spin in the opposite direction, but the moon doesn't quite go as fast because one day it has slipped 26 moon widths the opposite way, that is, eastward among the stars, or one moon width per hour. This is really easy to remember.
Yeah.
The moon moves its own width per hour eastward or leftward against the background stars, while the background stars are whizzing at, 15 degrees or 30 moon widths per hour toward the west.
So, because of our movement.
Because of our movement.
Okay.
So let's distill this. The moon and the background stars are moving about 30 moon widths per hour westward as you watch.
Mm-hmm.
But meantime, the moon has slipped just one moon width the other way, eastward, thanks to its orbital motion.
Got it. Very well put. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551. The number, Jules in Hillsdale. Jules, you're on.
Hey, Ray and Bob. A bit of a diversion, global warming and anthropogenic warming, et cetera. Your Chapter 18, Cold Winds of Sun's Heartbeat, is my go-to reference for anything, any factual information on global warming and human-induced stuff. One thing I was looking at recently, because I know one of the things you mentioned in there as a factor is things like particulate matter from volcanic explosions and so on. There was, I was looking at some NASA data on aerosols, and specifically the number of aerosols that were around back at the ozone hole time, and with the chlorofluorocarbons, and also with the power station emissions and acid rain problems. And I guess the data I saw said that as those chlorofluorocarbons were reduced, and as we had some reduction in particulate or aerosols from the power stations, and the acid rain dropped off in level, there was a noticeable change in the aerosol content, which I think over the 10-year period resulted in a 0.4 degree Fahrenheit change. But you didn't specifically talk about those aerosols in the book, but you did mention the effects of things like Mount Pinatubo. But I found that kind of interesting.
Well, thanks. I really appreciate that. The Sun's Heartbeat is now, 4 years old since I wrote it, and I'm really happy to see, maybe just by plain dumb good luck, that the that the things in that chapter saying that the sun appears to be coming to our rescue by putting out less energy, because we've had this very wimpy solar maximum. Remember, I mentioned in the book that solar maximum number 24 was approaching, and many thought that it would be a wimpy maximum. It has. It's been only about half the strength that we normally expect. And for this reason, many think, we may be entering an extended period of solar quiet, and this is translating into a lower amount of energy, especially in the ultraviolet, but even in the visible. Normally, said it in the book, that each square meter on the ground gets 1,366 watts, like about 17 light bulbs, 100-watt light bulbs worth of sunlight. And that varies only a little bit with the sunspot cycle, much more in the UV, but it sets in motion a cascade of other effects that ends up really affecting Earth's climate. So the sun appears to be keeping, as you know, our global warming has been pretty plateaued. It's been pretty flat for 17 years, which is really weird since that record year of 1998, which was the warmest year on record. It's true that it was a little hotter in 2005, 2010, and again last year in 2014. These were all record years, but they were records by only a few hundredths of a degree. In fact, the temperatures have been essentially flat, like a plateau, for 17 years. And nobody predicted that back in 1998. We all thought the temperatures on Earth were going to keep going up and up and up and up like crazy. So there's something else going on besides our carbon emissions that's having an effect. And the sun may be it, or maybe at least one of these factors. Yeah, Pinatubo in 92 definitely had a cooling effect.
Jules, thanks a lot for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob, this one came in via email. How would Earth be affected by having multiple moons? Why doesn't Earth have multiple moons?
Well, you know, it's a funny situation that the first two planets, Mercury and Venus, have no moons. We have one. Mars has two. Then you get this giant gap before you start getting to the Jovian, the giant worlds, and they all have lots and lots of them, dozens on each one of the planets from that point on. So it's a function probably of the inner solar system, how we formed, the sun's influence, the sun's gravity. For example, Mercury, there's a good chance mathematically that Mercury will be stripped from its orbit and collide with Venus in the next 5 billion years. So there's a fair amount of instability going on here that you don't see in the outer solar system, and that may have something to do with it. Also, we apparently, this is how everyone thinks the moon formed, we apparently got hit by a fortuitous Mars-sized body 4-point-something billion years ago, which ended up giving us the moon. And the moon, in turn, has this salutary effect on Earth, whereas our axis of tilt is regulated by the moon's presence. Math shows that we should go up from tilts gradually over time to facing the sun, 90-degree tilt, back to 0 to 90. And when it's 90, everything would be so hot on Earth, life couldn't survive. Huh. Instead, we have this 23.5-degree tilt right now. It never gets to more than 2 degrees more than that, never gets to more than 2 degrees less than that. So every bunches of tens of thousands of years, our tilt slightly changes one way or the other. And this is a very modulating, important effect that the moon has on us that helps keep, make it comfortable enough for life. So it's a very fortunate thing. Why we had this one single impact that gave us this one big moon, and Venus had none. No such luck, even though it's the same, essentially the same size as ours, you know, is anyone's guess.
Well, you know, there was this book from the 50s, Russian guy, Velikovsky.
Velikovsky, Emmanuel
Worlds
Velikovsky.
In Collision.
Yeah, I read that.
You read that.
Came out in 1950,
did I.
Yes.
Right. And I think he postulated that Venus was the object, right? That
he did. And it was a very persuasive, and now we realize totally wacky book. He was a psychologist, not a physicist.
Right.
And he made so many basic mistakes in that, but essentially he said that everything in the Bible could be explained by if the fact was that we Earth stopped for a while. That's why you could have had the things, certain passages in the Bible, the manna from heaven. What was that? That fed the fleeing Israelites. Well, that was carbohydrates that rained down on Earth.
Ha!
Because don't we know that comets contain carbohydrates? So chunks of that rained down and fed the fleeing Israelites. But if you knew some physics when you're reading the book, you'd say to yourself, no, comets don't have carbohydrates. They have hydrocarbons.
Well, you know,
you can't live off hydrocarbons unless you're on a severe diet, I guess.
Well, it was a fun book to read as a kid, and it must have been quite a book in the 50s. However, in the 50s, and we'll get right back to the phones. Gene in Parksville, you're next. However, in the 50s, it was postulated that Venus was this lovely, lush, blue world, and he was the guy who said, no, it's an inferno.
That's right. That's
and he was ahead of his time there, but not for the right reasons.
That's right. Exactly right.
All right, back to the phones, and let's go to Gene in Parksville. Gene.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you doing?
Good. You're on.
Okay. My question is about harvesting the sun's energy for powering spacecrafts for long-distance flights. I'm not speaking of the amount of insolation that would power PV wings. I'm speaking about solar wind. How come we're not using that? And what is the mechanics of that to harvest solar wind to power spacecrafts for deep space flight?
For deep space, you're right. You may have hit on something because the solar wind, you see, there's a low specific impulse there. So what you've got with a giant sail, which technologically may be difficult but not impossible, is a slight solar pressure of photons and, as we know, subatomic particles that are coming from the sun. Typically around here, they're 200 or 300 miles per second. And hitting that would only give the tiniest, slightest nudge. But since it's continuous, day and night, there is no night up there, it would slowly give an increase in speed. And if your goal is going to the stars, by the time you reach Pluto, of course, at Pluto's distance, the sun's light is 1,600 times weaker. So that's sort of a stopper. But we've used that kind of thing with the plasma propulsion system used to visit the comet Vilt 2. We use exactly that kind of thing, except instead of a solar sail, we used a plasma propulsion. So those things are possible if you don't have to get any place in a hurry, if it's not a manned mission, if you've got a long distance and you don't care about accelerating at a very slow rate. That may be the wave of the future.
Well, thank you very much for the call, Gene. We appreciate it. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. James in Statsburg. James, you're on.
Yes, I had a question. Something I've never been able to satisfactorily answer by the usual Google methods. You mentioned the regulation of the tilt of the axis by the moon, and we do know that the axis wobbles a bit. Does that ever cause solstices to be measurably longer or shorter in a given year?
Now, when you say longer or shorter, you know, there's
in other words,
the solstice
maximum
is only at a given moment.
The maximum length of day in a given location, does it ever vary slightly?
Oh, yes. And you're exactly right. It would vary depending upon the tilt of the Earth. Of the three things that happens, that is the direction of our axial tilt, which changes over a period of 25,780 years. In other words, that's the famous precession.
Right.
The changing in the orbital eccentricity of the Earth, becoming a rounder orbit and then a more eccentric orbit. And the final thing is the changing of the amount of tilt that we have, the one that we were just speaking about, Ray and I, just a little bit ago. That's the one, that latter one, is the one that would regulate the intensity of sunlight at the solstices. You know, as we all know or should know, a object with no tilt at all, like Mercury, it's got no axial tilt, only about a 20th of a degree, and Jupiter, that has only a 3-degree tilt, has no seasons. Because if you don't have any tilt, nothing changes during the year. The amount of sunlight stays the same. We and Saturn and Mars all have 20-something degrees, so the amount of axial tilt is vital. Even a changing of 1 degree gives you more, a sun that's higher up overhead, and sun intensity varies with how high it is in the sky. It's a sine wave pattern. So you get a lot more sunlight on the solstices if you have a greater tilt. So this is a long-winded way of answering your question, where I could have just said, yes, you're right.
Right. How much variation is there? Might the day be a few seconds longer if the axis is more tilted in any given year?
Yes, and it would depend on your latitude, because the length of the day is a function, no matter what the tilt is, of your latitude. For example,
right.
Here, if you lived in Fairbanks on the solstice, you would only have... Well, it depends upon which solstice, but let's say on the summer solstice, you'd have about 21 hours of sunlight and only 3 hours of night. But, you know, travel some distance away from that, like the equator, and you're still 12 and 12, and that's regardless of your tilt.
We're going to take a break here. Bob Berman is our guest. 1-800-348-2551 is the telephone number. And, boy, this hour is going quickly. We'll hit the home stretch in a moment.
Comes from Edgar Bosick, Certified Financial Planner, Private Financial Design, South Hadley. Your life, your plan, your portfolio. PrivateFinancialDesign.com. Securities through Cambridge Investment Research, member FINRA and SIPC. Carrie Haddad Gallery, Hudson, New York, presenting Color Theory, an exhibit of abstract paintings by Vincent Pomelio, James O'Shea, and Stephen Brophy, through November 15th. Open every day, CarrieHaddadGallery.com. The Lathrop community, serving older adults in the Quaker tradition for 25 years. Independent living in Northampton and East Hampton, Massachusetts, in the heart of the Pioneer Valley. Lathrop.Kendall.org. College Street Motors, Amherst, Massachusetts, specializing in foreign and domestic car and truck repair services and 24-hour towing and recovery service for over 30 years. CollegeStreetMotors.com. Sheehy Opticians, Albany, New York, providing eyeglasses, including Bevel, Lafond, and Pro Design, progressive lenses from Verilux, and Nikon and Maui Jim, Costa, and Rudy Project sunglasses. SHEEHYOpticians.com. And the Honest Wade Food Co-op, 100 Waterville Ave, Albany, New York. Specializing in local and organic produce, natural groceries, fine cheeses, locally raised meats, and ready-to-go organic meals. HonestWade.coop.
1-800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Bob Berman is here, and his latest book is Zoom, How Everything Moves, although there's another one or two in the works, so stand by. As soon as they are fit for human consumption, we will tell you all about those on the program. Bob, this one came in via email from Bonnie. Dear Bob, please describe the latest discoveries about Pluto. And we heard a little bit about those in the news. An atmosphere, yeah?
Yeah, a very thin atmosphere. Pluto's full of surprises. I don't know why we're surprised. The whole universe, you know, leaps out and goes boo whenever we discover anything new.
Yeah.
But Pluto's a beloved world, and the fact that instead of it being flat and just cratered and being uninteresting, it's got mountains, it's got changeable atmosphere, it's got strange, flatter areas, which shows that it's got an active geology. Now, when you're that small, our moon is 2,160 miles. Pluto's only 1,400, if I remember right, 73, or is it 83 miles in diameter? Let's round it off to 1,480 miles in diameter.
All right.
It's only two-thirds the size of our moon, and when an object's that small, and especially that far from the sun, you'd expect a cold interior, a frozen interior,
yeah,
the way Mars has apparently gotten. So why are we seeing any kind of internal activity on an object this small? Why are we seeing changes on the surface that shows changing active dynamic geology? So it was a surprise, a happy surprise, because, you know, we love things that aren't dead, but that change. And that's what we've got with the moon. So I'd say that was the first one. Of course, the images and the data are still coming to the spacecraft, to the New Horizons, and thence to Earth. It's also nice seeing Charon, its moon, after all these years of these things just being little dots, now having images of these things. It's lovely.
So then they have active, there is active geology on Pluto. Does that mean there are also volcanoes?
I didn't see any caldera or volcanoes.
Okay.
I didn't see that on any of the images. So I don't think that's the case.
Well, what is the engine for active geology?
Well, that's the thing. The engine is usually something interior.
Right. Heat, right?
Heat is the first thing, of course. Heat produces everything. In some places in the solar system, even fairly far out, like some of the moons of both Jupiter and Saturn, you have under the surface water, pools of water. You have geysers springing up. Sometimes they immediately turn to ice, as they do with Saturn's moon Enceladus. Planet quakes on the surface that change it. For example, Venus's entire surface gets a makeover every something like 10 million or so years or so, which is nothing on the cosmic scale, and it completely gets erased and remade. Planetary astronomers debate whether these are sudden events or whether they happen slowly, but some planets are very, very active. Other objects like the moon, nothing seems to happen for billions of years. I mean, it's truly a dead world. So why do you get a Pluto, which is much farther away, much smaller than the moon? Why do you have something that's so dynamic there when you don't have that close up? And nobody really knows the answers yet.
Does it have an iron core? Is there a magnetic field on Pluto? Do we know?
I don't think so. I don't think so. But don't take my word for
okay.
it.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the phones. Sean in Middletown. Sean.
Hi. How you doing, guys? Awesome show.
Thanks.
I had a couple questions about Mars and the water that was recently been discovered on it. One was, how definitive is it that what was in fact seen is water? Two would be, what are the chances of life on Mars because of the discovered water? And three is, what does that mean for mankind as far as possibly colonizing Mars in the distant future? And I'll just take my answer off the phone.
Great, Sean. And, of course, the movie The Martian has everyone thinking about this. So
they do.
Go ahead there, Mr. Berman.
Okay. As you know, the last month or two, I've been running around. I just did the Ideas Festival in Louisville, and I've only been getting cursory news about this. A month or two later, I get the journals, and then I read about it in greater detail. So my knowledge of the Martian water is still kind of preliminary at this point. But let's just say this. Anytime you have water, you've got a great chance for life, although we have no idea about the oceans under Europa and some of the other Jupiter moons under Enceladus. We used to think there was no other pools of water beyond Earth in our solar system, and now we're finding more and more and more of them. So if Mars, which it does, shows evidence, we didn't actually find liquid water, but evidence that shows that liquid water flowed there, it can't flow on the surface, by the way. It cannot, because the atmosphere is only 1% as thick as ours. So any water that appears on the surface, which presumably comes up like a spring and appears on the surface, if it flowed, it would be very brief, because at those low pressures, any water would boil away and also freeze solid at the same time. They would boil and freeze and could not remain water. So we can't find lakes or ponds or flowing rivers on Mars. You maybe were able to find that millions or billions of years ago when Mars had a thicker atmosphere, but at the current atmospheric pressure of Mars, it just can't exist. So to answer our caller's question, we're talking subsurface. You also want to go subsurface to escape the horrendous radiation that's always hitting the Martian surface, mostly thanks to galactic cosmic rays, but also because of solar cosmic rays as well.
And so what happened storms to evaporate the atmosphere that was once on Mars?
We don't know. I mean, the main theory is that as the Martian core went from an active core like ours to a perhaps crystallized, where it could no longer have a dynamo effect the way Earth does, it got to the effect where it no longer, because Mars has no global magnetic field.
Right.
And that's one of the shields against cosmic radiation. And, you know, it's cooled. It's changed over time. It can no longer not only hold an atmosphere, it can't hold water either. So we're talking about under the surface. So what does that mean for us? Well, for people visiting, don't forget, you still can't breathe the air. You still have a high radiation flux. It would be no picnic being on Mars. On Earth, you think of the Himalayan peaks as being inhospitable. And they are, or living under the ocean, 20,000 feet under the ocean, as inhospitable, which it would be. Nobody's lining up to live in these places. But Mars is much, much, much worse than these places that no one is living on Earth. So when we talk about colonizing Mars, let's remember we're talking about colonizing a place that would be a lot harder and more expensive and more threatening to human life than the inhospitable regions of Earth where no one is cares to live. So, okay. You know, we need to be realistic.
Well, let's go to Marcel in Windsor. Marcel, you're on.
Hi, thank you. This is more about atmospheric pressure. With global warming, we're looking at sea level rise, and I was just curious, if we had a sea level rise of about 3 feet, what would that do to the atmospheric pressure on the Earth? Because right now it's at 14.7 pounds per square inch. Would that increase or would it decrease with the sea level rise?
Well, the sea level rise per se wouldn't do anything because a few feet doesn't matter. And even if it went up a mile, it really wouldn't matter because the amount of air above the Earth is still the amount of air. And the atmospheric pressure essentially is a function of the weight of all the air on top of it. Currently, the halfway point for Earth's atmosphere in terms of weight is at 18,000 feet.
Okay.
So if you go to that height, half of the atmosphere is below you, half of the atmosphere is above you by weight. So the only thing that would change is whatever, if the sea level rose 3 feet, then the halfway point would be 18,000 and 3 feet. So that wouldn't do anything. The more important issue is what would our atmosphere do in terms of holding more substances, and I'm talking about water vapor. Now, water vapor is very light because 2/3 of it by volume is hydrogen. The oxygen component is 9 times heavier than the hydrogen component, meaning when you have a glass of water, 8/9 of that water is oxygen by weight, but 2/3 of that glass is hydrogen by volume. So when you have a warmer and warmer atmosphere, as global warming would presumably do, more air, the air would hold more water because of higher temperatures, that's what happens. But water vapor tends to be kind of lightweight. So I don't see that as contributing very much to atmospheric pressure, but it would contribute something. So long-winded way to answer your question, we probably have a little bit more atmospheric pressure just because of the additional water vapor.
And thank you, Marcel, for the call. The number to call is 1-800-348-2551. Getting back to Mars and the disappearance of the magnetic field. And given the variances and the sort of mystery about our magnetic field, do you ever stay up at night worrying that one day ours will just be gone?
No, not at all, because we've now looked at it over 150 of these magnetic field line changes, the last one 700 and something thousand years ago. And apparently it happens pretty often, 3 times per million years on Earth. It never correlates with mass extinctions or biological effects because we know exactly when they happened, and this was never a period of time that matches up any biological changes on Earth.
But that's not my point. The point is, a billion years ago, or however many hundreds of millions of years ago, Mars had a magnetic field that suddenly, or at least in a relatively short period of time, went away.
So could that happen to us?
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're more massive. We both spin in the same period of time. The spin is another function of the dynamo effect. The Martian spin is only half an hour slower than ours. Ours is 23 hours, 56 minutes, and 4.1 seconds. The Martian is 24 hours, 37 minutes, 23 seconds. So what is that? That's about 37 minutes more than ours. About the same, essentially.
Yeah.
But the mass of the Earth is greater. I don't think... Here's the thing that could worry somebody if you really wanted to be paranoid.
Oh, I like to be worried about things.
Okay.
So please tell
me. Well, since 1850, Earth's magnetic field has decreased by 10%.
This is what I'm saying, Bob.
10% reduction. But nobody knows if a mere 10% reduction over the last, 150 years is normal, and that Earth's magnetic field strength always goes up and goes down and varies a little bit from time to time, because although we know the direction of our magnetic field lines going back many millions of years, thanks to the fact that ferromagnetic minerals will line up
yeah.
with every magnet. As soon as it cools below the Curie temperature, I think that's 1,414 degrees, as soon as that happens with lava solidifying, boom, you get a lineup of the current magnetic field, and so we could read it like a book.
Yeah.
So these things are normal, but this changing strength, that's the only thing that's a little weird. But you can't read the strength of previous fields from the rocks. So we have no idea whether what's currently happening is unusual or not.
Okay. So I'm all right. So it's a flip of the coin. I'll still be worried. You can relax. Let's go to Martha in Albany. Martha.
Hi. I'm going to North Central Canada at the end of the week, and I would like to know if there's any chance of seeing northern lights at this time of year.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now that we've got away from the sunspot, never mind that. We're still only a year from sunspot maximum. There still is a goodly number of northern lights happening in the magnetic or what's called the auroral oval that really surrounds the North Magnetic Pole, and that very much Central Canada is where you want to be. So if you get away from the lights of town, you have a good shot at seeing the northern lights. In fact, are there even towns there? You know, you probably don't have to go very far to be in dark skies there.
Right. Is there a good website for tracking this?
There is. And you can go to the POES, P-O-E-S. You can go to the University of Alaska auroral website, and it's going to show you the predictions for several days to come of auroral activity. And what you're looking for is anything that's a 3 or a 4 on their scale, and that will bring you auroras in the place where you're going to be at least down lowish on the northern horizon, if not overhead. A 4 will bring it overhead there. A 3 will let you see it from there down low toward the north.
How accurate are the predictions?
They're pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Martha. You know, I've seen maybe one outstanding northern lights.
You mean
in
here
in
upstate New York? Yeah, we get them here. It's a long time now. We had a beautiful one in the fall of 2001. We had a lovely one in the fall of 2000. We had an all-sky aurora on March 13th, 89. That was all night long. That filled the sky from horizon to horizon. It was the wildest thing that I saw just fine from the Catskills.
Yeah.
And so we've gotten great displays from here.
I remember a spectacular one in the early 80s, maybe late 70s, that was unbelievable.
Yeah, we get them. We're kind of overdue. We haven't had a great one here for a while, but can happen anytime.
Well, I mean, every now and then you hear, oh, they saw one. They had a nice northern lights in the south. And I'm thinking, well, why wasn't it spectacular here?
Right. Now, the difference is it just a glow? Because sometimes you'll just see the sky glowing in the north. And by the way, the peak direction from here is not north, but northwest, because that's the direction towards the auroral oval. The magnetic pole is not north from here. It's 13 degrees west of that.
So northwest is the way to look.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've seen the glow. In fact, the last time they said you may get, there was a storm on the sun, you may get some great auroras. Didn't see much from my house, but did see the glow.
Right. But you're in the Albany area.
And the lights. It's tough to differentiate.
Yeah.
Yeah, between the city lights and everything else. All right, Bob, I guess we're about done. The latest book is Zoom, How Everything Moves. It's on Little Brown, right?
Yes.
Okay, and it's doing well?
I think, you know, it's every 6 months that I get a report. I guess one is due.
When do the checks come in? That's the main thing.
You know, I don't know. I haven't gotten anything
from that. You haven't
gotten
a check? All right, you need a new agent, man. You really need a new agent. All right, so new books are on the way, and we'll talk about those in future programs. You're heading to Chile.
Heading to Chile in 2 weeks from now, bringing our yearly group down to see the major telescopes, and we rent out a mountaintop observatory one of the nights. It's a great tour. I'm looking forward to that. Yeah,
well, yeah. Bob Berman, always fun to have you on the show. Thanks to you for being here. Support comes from Colby Attorney Service, document filing, document and information retrieval, and other services, including legal publishing and corporate record searches, colbyservice.com. Adams Ross Cut Stone, Albany, New York, providing an array of natural stone for outdoor patios, walkways, retaining walls, pools, and home entertaining. AdamRossCutStone.com. Stories Nursery, Freehold, New York, featuring a variety of mums, fall decorations, and bulbs, including organic garlic bulbs for spring, Monday through Saturday, 8 to 5, Sundays 9 to 4, a gardener's destination, storiesnursery.com. And The Hyde Collection, an art museum and historic house in Glens Falls, New York, open Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 5, Sunday 12 to 5, hydecollection.org. That's it for Vox Pop today. Thanks again to astronomer Bob Berman. Thanks to you for listening and for calling and for emailing and for tweeting. Always nice. Thanks to Zach Malloy at the controls of this starship. Deb Malik answered your calls. Our producer is Jessica Blaustein Marshall. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow it's a Food Friday, and we welcome back the always entertaining Deanna Fox. Stay tuned now for news.